fluffy bread, fresh tortillas, classic burger buns, and so many carbs. Carb fear is real. But Hero Bread makes healthier versions of the carb-heavy favorites we love most. We're talking fewer calories, 0 to 2 grams net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and seriously, great taste. Made from a new recipe using heart-healthy olive oil and resistant wheat starch that acts as a prebiotic fiber to promote gut health, Hero Bread products have more of the dietary fiber and protein you want without the net carbs and sugar you don't. There's something for every craving. Sliced bread loaves, buns, and tortillas, plus monthly small batch drops of indulgent favorites with no compromise. Like the 2-gram net carb Hero croissant or the 1-gram net carb Hero cheddar biscuit. Don't skip out on your favorites. Just use Hero Bread. Get 10% off your order at hero.co with code HEROPOD at checkout. That's HEROPOD at HERO.co.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, February 3rd, 2020, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santamaria. I am actually right now in New York City, if I'm doing my math right, and about to head out to Kazakhstan to watch a rocket launch, which I'm super excited about, but I'm really freaked out because it's going to be very, very cold. Wish me luck. It should be a lot of fun. And of course, if you're listening to this right when it drops on Monday, that means that there's an all new Brain Games coming out tonight on National Geographic Channel. So I hope you'll tune in and see what we're up to this week. All right. First, I want to thank those of you who have made Talk Nerdy possible this week. Remembering that Talk Nerdy is a free service that I provide. So really, the show is supported through ad sales, but I don't always sell ads. For example, this week, there is no ad on the show. And so I really do heavily rely on the support from those of you who want to share to help it so that this show can continue to be on the air. And, you know, I have some really great supporters this month, this week specifically. I want to thank, you know, I'm going to do these in order of lifetime support, I think, because I have some really top tier, like lifetime supporters. Let me just switch this up so I can do that. Wow. Yeah. Jeffrey Sewell, I think you get a legacy shout out. You are incredible. Brian Holden, second lifetime supporter. Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Phil Tiber, David J.E. Smith, Juan, Ken Pfeiffer, Christian Jeffrey, David Compton, Juan Gutierrez, Jacob Rochester, and Doug Petipier. Thank you guys so much. And then in terms of weekly support, those of you who are pledging at the top tier but maybe haven't been doing it for as long, I also want to thank Daniel Lang. I want to thank the Zombie Drummer, Dudas Infinitas, Ulrika Hagman, Sinai, Pasquale Gelati, and last but certainly not least, Mary Neva and her son, Jim Cooper Schmidt. Thank you guys so, so very much for keeping this thing going. All right, guys, this week is a really fun episode because I have the opportunity to sit down with Susanna Harris. She's a PhD candidate in microbiology at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill and the founder and CEO of PhD Balance, a collaborative community empowering graduate students to build their personal and professional resilience. So, guys, without any further ado, here she is, Susanna Harris. Well, Susanna, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. It is an absolute honor to be here.
Oh, I'm so excited to have a chat with you. I feel like there's so much that we have to talk about. But before we do, I thought it would be kind of cool to read the email that we received recommending you as a guest. So hopefully she's okay with it. She didn't write anywhere on here that we shouldn't, you know, use her name or share anything. So this is from Anna. And Anna said, I'm a listener of your podcast, which I love. It's interesting, blah, blah, blah. It's all very sweet at the top, but I feel weird reading it. But very nice things about Talk Nerdy. And then she said, I have heard an interview with Susanna Harris in another podcast, This Week in Microbiology, and kept thinking how well she would fit as one of your interviewees. She suffered and fought with mental health issues and has now established a group to give support to graduates undergoing PhD training, PhD balance. She's incredibly articulate and honest about her experience. Very inspiring. Please check out this video. Thank you for your work in SciComm and your promotion of diversity in science. You too are a role model. All the best, Anna. Isn't that sweet?
That is fantastic. Now I really want to know which Anna this is, but yeah, the internet people can be really, really lovely.
They can be, right? And it's always refreshing when that happens too, mm-hmm. because when you spend a lot of time on Twitter, you forget that, I think. So yeah, so she reached out. I immediately was like, yes, 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 this is amazing. I watched a little bit of, I've watched a couple interviews with you talking about some of the work that you do. So I thought we would chat about, I think, kind of both things today, both the academic work that you do, but also the kind of advocacy, or maybe you could call it the kind of inclusivity and support that you do through PhD Balance. So I guess to start, what are you studying? Where are you at? Like, you know, what's your graduate experience right now?
Yeah, what's my day job? So I am at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, and I have been here for about 5 years. I am studying microbiology, and specifically what I'm looking at is how different groups of bacteria will stick to plant roots. Yeah, it's a really fantastic project. It's nice to still be excited about that project.
And the bacteria that you're studying, are they bacteria that are like symbiotically living with these plants? Are they bacteria that are actually making the plants sick? What is the kind of, I guess, interest or the function around the bacteria itself?
Yeah. So kind of why do we care, which is I'm working on this paper right now. So that's the working on the introduction part. And that's all that's in my head. So the main bacteria we look at is Bacillus subtilis. And this is a super common bacterium found in soils all over the world. Fun fact, it was found in the International Space Station.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Just kind of random.
That's the one, huh?
Yeah.
Right? There was like one bacteria that was found there. That's the one.
Yeah. And what's so cool about it, the reason, you know, they find that stuff everywhere is that it forms these really hardy spores, which are basically like the seed version of a bacterium. And why we care about this is that when we add this bacterium to plants, a lot of different plants are then more able to grow and they're more resistant to pathogens. So different fungus and bacteria that would normally invade the plant and kill it and reduce crop productivity. Adding Bacillus subtilis has been shown from, you know, model organisms like the one I work on to tomatoes and melons. And what we're really excited about is that we're looking at how different bacteria that are found in the soil might help Bacillus subtilis to stay with the plant longer and allow us to use that instead of chemical fertilizers.
Oh, very cool. So it's, I guess, not the first thing that people think of when they think of bacteria as having like a strong protective mechanism. But this not only is, has an evolutionary advantage, but also could be utilized by human beings potentially for commercial purposes.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, it's already being sold by a bunch of different agricultural companies as plant additives. And one of the things we were really interested in is we were looking through the literature and found that there was evidence that maybe Bacillus subtilis and other Bacillus species were really helpful, but in crop field settings weren't actually staying with the plant for long enough, or at least not across its lifespan. And then we got this chance to talk with other scientists, and more people kept saying, oh, yeah, we saw that. We weren't really sure what to do with it, but it's already published that other people can do it. And so basically what we did is we came up with this system where we not only look at the initial colonization where the bacillus sticks to the plant root, but we also look at what happens over time when we put it into a system that doesn't have as much of that sugar that the bacteria likes. And sure enough, we saw that Bacillus falls off of the plant root.
Oh, fascinating. And is that kind of the crux, like the findings that you came to throughout your PhD research?
A little bit. So, you know, as you know, with PhD research, you kind of end up taking these very strange tangents where we originally realized it because I wanted to look at these interspecies interactions between bacteria. So in the area around roots is called the rhizosphere. So sphere, just kind of that area around. And it usually includes the root itself as well as the soil around. And there are so many bacteria in that soil. And I wanted to look at how are those bacteria interacting with each other? Are they changing each other's behaviors? And we came up with this hydroponic system. And we were really excited to use Bacillus in it. And then it just kept failing. We were like, why is this falling off? Yeah, yeah. And so, well, that's why we started looking in the literature. We started asking around and saying, does anyone else see this happening? And people said, yeah, but it doesn't really go with what is already talked about. And so we kind of just ignored that question side, or it was brought up briefly, but we don't really know what to do with it. And so we found out that our system allows other bacteria to survive on the plant roots and to coexist with the plant over time. And that's really where we came up with this idea of like, okay, maybe our system's not broken. We can publish the system. It's still really useful. But why is Bacillus falling off? And can we use this as a way to estimate what might be happening in those fields?
That's fascinating. And so where along the kind of path are you? You have, and I guess we should talk about what some of these terms mean, but you are a PhD candidate now. Are you mostly finished with your dissertation, or are you still in the writing process?
I'm still in the writing process. I'm fairly lucky here at UNC, at least in the microbiology department, that we are able to make our dissertation fill it with chapters that have been published already. So for instance, the system we came up with, we have a methods paper out there. And so I'm able to use that as one of my chapters. The big holdup right now is that this final set of experiments that we're doing to pull together this paper showing all these really cool results, just piecing that all together, doing the last bits of experiments, and you know, the science gods that be, I don't know, have realized that it's the final push. And so they're throwing every distraction that they can at us. But the bacteria know. They know when you've got a presentation coming up or you need to get a paper out. And they're just like, yeah, not today.
So are you still having to collect a little bit of data to get this paper done?
Yeah, I am. And it's kind of an interesting time because my PI, the primary investigator who runs our lab, recently accepted a position up at UMass Worcester. And she actually moved in December, and we are kind of packing up the lab, figuring out what to do with that. And so I have a couple months maybe to get the rest of the data that I need and really write this up to be able to graduate hopefully in May.
Oh, very cool. Gosh, you're so close. I'm so jealous.
Yes. How much longer do you think you have? I know it's a horrible question.
I mean, no, it's not. It's an important question, I think. So I'm a third year. And if everything were to accelerate or to kind of go at the pace that it's been going, I would actually be doing the second half of my quals this coming semester, in the summer semester. And I would be getting my proposal approved, and I'd be getting IRB approval, and I could apply for internship, which would mean then that next year I would work on my dissertation full time, and then the year after I would do my internship, because for a PhD in clinical psych, you do a full clinical psychology pre-doc internship in addition to all the practicum hours that you get prior to internship. Yeah, it's a lot.
So
because it's kind of a hybrid, it's a scientist practitioner degree. Mm-hmm. But the TV show that I am on, it looks like we may be able to film another season, and it's just going to kill me to try and do all of that at once. So I'm thinking I'm actually going to take next semester, I'm going to take leave next semester, mm-hmm. which will push me back a year. Mm-hmm. So I'll be on a 6-year track instead of a 5-year track, which I'm okay with. Mm-hmm. And that means that I'm about halfway finished at this point. So I would be set to graduate if everything goes right in, let's see, what year is it? It's 2020. So in 2022, mm-hmm. does that sound right?
Yeah. I think so.
So, yeah, we'll see. You never know. Life takes you on a lot of twists and turns. But basically, I'm done with my coursework other than like two classes, basically my quals and my final assessment class I need to take still. And then I'm about halfway done with my practicum hours. So this allows me some breathing room to not have to like lose my mind getting mm-hmm. my practicum hours done. Mm-hmm. My school requires just over 1,500 direct practicum hours prior to interviewing for or applying for your internship.
Wow.
And yeah, and the internship in clinical psych is kind of like the match program in med school. Mm-hmm. Like you apply to a bunch of schools, you rank them, they rank you, you hope that you match because there's, you know, a lot of people applying for these accredited sites. Mm-hmm. So the hardest thing for me is, I think, going to be that year-long internship. As of right now, I've been able to kind of balance work and school. I've been able to really like focus on my mental health as well and do, you know, a lot of the things that I want to do that kind of bring me joy. Mm-hmm. An internship is going to just be a big lifestyle change for me because it's like a 9-to-5, 40 hours a week classic position, which I can't remember the last time I wasn't freelance and didn't have like a really flexible, weird, build your own schedule. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be a big challenge for me. I know I'm going to like it, but I think it's going to be challenging for me.
Yeah. Well, and just seeing all the really cool different projects that you do and that you've done, I have to assume that, you know, you're going to be doing the 40 hours a week, but let's be honest, you're not going to just be working 40 hours a week.
Yeah, I think that realistically, I'll be able to still podcast both on this show and on Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, but I probably honestly won't be able to do any TV stuff. Mm-hmm. I think I'll have to be keeping talks and things like that to a minimum because otherwise I'm just not going to be as present mm-hmm. as I need to be for the clients, for the patients. Mm-hmm. As it is right now, it's starting to become really difficult mm-hmm. because consistency is important in therapy, right? Like mm-hmm. when you establish this relationship with, I work with kids in foster care right mm-hmm. now, girls who are living in a residential facility. And every time I have to leave for a week and there's like a gap in their service, or every time I have to switch from a Tuesday to a Thursday or a Friday, I feel guilty. I really do. Like it actually really affects me because I feel like I'm not being consistent for these kids who their whole lives have just been made up of inconsistent adults. And so the one thing I really want to offer them is like a consistent kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Like guessable, like they know when I'm going to be there. Right. Like, and it's reliable every time I'm there. And so every time I'm not able to do that for them because of the work that I do, it's mm-hmm. kind of like, ugh, it's not a good feeling.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that just speaks to like how dedicated you are, not just to doing a PhD, right. Or getting the title. I think that that's so important when you're doing a PhD to be doing it because you have this passion for it. And it just sounds like you have even more than that, you feel this great responsibility to help other people.
Well, and the thing that I think is important, and like I'm really interested to hear your perspective on this, is kind of like there's a lot of different reasons people get PhDs, right? Mm-hmm. And I think you really can't slice and dice them and subdivide them, and they all play off of one another. They're inextricably linked. Mm-hmm. I think for a lot of us, there is this deep kind of pressure, and whether it's external or internal or some combination of the two, it's an achievement that we have kind of put into our consciousness as like the end all be all in our field, right? Like mm-hmm. once you have a PhD, you have the type of expertise or the type of authority where it's sort of, not that it's beyond reproach, it's absolutely mm-hmm. not beyond reproach, but it establishes kind of a blanket respectability in the mm-hmm. field. Mm-hmm. That said, it also, I think for many people serves as a credit to the eventual career trajectory that they plan to take. Mm-hmm. And what I see a lot of times, especially in some of my friends here in LA who went to really competitive universities, who got PhDs, you know, in very difficult fields and really, really like unhealthy labs, mm-hmm. they ended up leaving academia altogether, and not just leaving academia, but actually going into fields where they could have probably gotten the same job mm-hmm. with a bachelor's degree.
Mm-hmm. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And it's really interesting to see the, I guess the way that they sort of cognitively work through what that journey has meant to them. Obviously, they still use their PhDs every day. A PhD is something that is like massively universally helpful. Mm. But it is always really interesting to me to see what the kind of path is for a lot of people and sort of why they ended up pushing through and and doing that thing, even if in the future maybe it isn't, it hasn't been like a requirement on their resume, for example.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That it's this, like you said, hybrid of just all of these different motivations, where I definitely resonate with what you're saying as far as kind of credentials, that I am a very opinionated person, and there's something very attractive about being able to, you know, walk into a room and have a little bit of credit already going for me. Especially, I think I was extra aware of that. My mom was in corporate banking growing up in the Midwest. I grew up in Iowa, and one of the places that she worked was actually a very kind of old boys club. They had this thing, and it's always going to stick with me, where she went to this big corporate event, and it was held at this golf club place. I forgot what the actual term for a golf place is.
That sounds about right to me. I don't know.
Yeah. More people play golf, but they chose this place not realizing that women weren't even allowed on the course. Yeah. And I think it just really stuck with me of, you know, I think still in our society, you have to kind of prove yourself a little bit more as a woman, especially in science or in business. And I wanted to have something behind my name that would kind of boost me back up to a place where people might pay a bit of attention. And then, you know, it's combined with that. I just really love science. I fell in love with microbiology one day in junior year of high school, in some AP bio class. We learned about bacteria and viruses, I think, for 2 days. And I was like, that's the coolest thing I've ever heard. I just want to know everything about this. I want to understand, you know, and just be able to see the world in that different view. And then I found out that I could do that for a job, and I just started working towards it. PhD made sense. And I'm certainly still very glad that I chose this path, but it is interesting now looking back and trying to understand, you know, why did I choose this? Did it make sense given my goals? And, you know, why did I stick with it? Yeah. Especially like there were some really hard times in the middle, kind of what else could I have done instead?
Mm-hmm. And so now that you are kind of seeing the light at the end of the PhD tunnel, have you been thinking more about how your goals have maybe changed throughout the graduate school process? Like, do you plan to stay in academia? Do you plan to go into science communication full time? Like, do you know kind of what you want to do after you walk across that stage?
A little bit. It's nice to have. I just like deadlines, so it's nice to feel like this is you know, coming to an end point. No, my goals have totally changed. So when I started grad school, I was already fairly sure I didn't want to stay in academia. I like the idea of the mentorship aspect of being a PI or a lab director, but I wasn't totally sold on the entire system. And that has certainly cemented itself. But it was about 2 years into my PhD, I decided to set aside some time to start doing a little bit of science communication. There's a really fantastic science center here in Chapel Hill called the Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center. And I took this training course over a year where they taught scientists to turn their own research into something that was hands-on and exciting for about middle school age kids. I got the chance to go to these different middle schools in rural North Carolina and remember how cool science was. Yeah. And it was really exciting. It was super draining for me. I'm not an extrovert by any means. But then I found a way to still get that kind of practice. And now I get to be a trainer for that same exact system or that program and help other scientists communicate their science. And I think that is my passion, is definitely kind of connecting people who wouldn't necessarily communicate. So scientists really want to talk about their science. They have this idea that everyone wants to learn about it. And I think that they're right. They just have to do it in a way that can be appreciated. So something along those lines. I'm looking into going into science communication for businesses. That kind of looks like marketing. It kind of looks like, you know, working with research development as well as PR. Yeah, that kind of middle ground of how can we get these people to just have a conversation and see eye to eye.
Absolutely. And the cool thing about a PhD, I think probably one of the coolest things, is that, you know, for a lot of people, it's one of the hardest things you'll do in your life. And it really does show that, you know, by the time you've hacked your way through, it really shows that you're resourceful, that you have been resilient, that you are, you know, capable of solving really complex problems, capable of failing pretty miserably and then picking yourself up and, you know, trying again until you figure out something that works. And so really it prepares you for almost any position after you get through. Like, it doesn't necessarily even have to be in your field. It definitely doesn't have to be in academia. It's unlike almost any other type of training where, you know, we talk a lot about like things like Lumosity or like brain training games, and the literature tends to show that like, oh, doing Lumosity makes you really good at doing Lumosity, or that, you know, the GREs are really good at predicting how well you'll do on the GREs. But a PhD actually is really predictive, I think, of a lot of like life successes. It really does prepare you, probably because it's like, it's horrible. It's a really gross system that really needs to be overhauled. And if you can get through that, especially as a woman, you can probably get through anything.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And I think that one of the postdocs I worked under who, you know, postdocs have been my saving grace, that in microbiology or in a lot of fields of bench science, that they are someone who have already gotten their PhD, have already gone through the system, kind of have that hardened stance, but are still really excited about science. One of the people who really helped me, especially in the middle of my degree, she had as her PhD advisor someone who was really just verbally abusive. And but this person, she said, you know, I got to this point where this PI said, why would you ask that question? Are you stupid? And I said back, like, maybe, but I still want to know the answer. And
I love that.
Yeah, I think that has kind of been my motto of, you know, coming in, I wanted to be really smart. I wanted to do really great at everything. And now I'm just like, I want to get it done. I want to learn something. And, you know, I honestly, I don't care that much if somebody thinks I'm stupid, because I'm just going to keep going.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. Oh, and that must have been really incredible to be able to at the very least, whether you have, you know, really good mentors or not, at the faculty level. I do think that a lot of people have similar stories where they were able to connect with a postdoctoral fellow, or they will even were able to connect with a senior PhD student, like somebody who is maybe in a cohort a year or two ahead of them, to help them navigate a lot of the real challenges and to help them say, oh, steer clear of that lab. That guy is going to like harass you, or, you know, over here, you might find a lot of really good support, or, you know, they're going to take it personally if you go this route with your research. So mm-hmm. if you want to avoid that minefield, maybe you can go this route instead. There's so much kind of political and emotional, there's so many political and emotional issues that mm-hmm. you have to navigate mm-hmm. when you're in graduate school that a lot of people, I guess, don't really think about.
Mm-mm. No, and I was having this discussion with my with the PhD balance team. Actually, it's cool. There's a whole bunch of us, but talking about how oftentimes you start a PhD and you're told sort of nobody can tell you how to do this because everybody's path is unique, which that's really true. But that's a bit like saying, you know, I can't tell you how to get across this forest because you're going to take different steps than I did. And there's going to be different branches on the ground. Really, the best resources are the people who are going through it, like you said, who are a couple steps ahead of you or have recently gotten through. And they're the ones who are going to, you know, reach back and say, hey, you know, go around this obstacle, or, you know, that just know that this is going to be coming up for you. And I think what's been really interesting to see is that a person's experience can totally depend on who is around them and how willing or able they are to help them.
True. Yeah. And I think you see the same kinds of pressures and the same kinds of support structures in place that I've experienced from working both in academia, but also in media, like kind of going the academic route and also going the Hollywood route, is that especially for women, for people of color, for like intersectional individuals who are dealing with a lot of kind of like systemic and institutional prejudice, what you often find is that there are the people who understand that we're not going to get through unless we support each other. And you find the people who have been, unfortunately, kind of have internalized the very kind of American and I think cis white male, you know, Protestant, whatever view mm-hmm. that like it's dog eat dog, it's cutthroat, don't make alliances mm-hmm. because helping each other is only going to make it so, you know, so you have to beat each other in the end. And it's mm-hmm. so unfortunate to see people who are dealing with the same issues, who come from similar backgrounds, kind of being competitive instead of being collaborative. Mm-hmm. It's just it's a real bummer when that is the outcome, which unfortunately I think sometimes I can't blame the person for that being their mentality, because there's so many pressures that are putting them in that position.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a hard one, right? I think it's so cyclical of saying, well, the culture is competitive and this is what you have to do to get by. And I mean, so often you hear people say like, well, once I'm established, then I'm really excited to take down these things. But yeah. You know, I don't think in academia you really do hit that point of stability. Maybe, you know, when you're 60, 70 or so, and what are they going to do to you? But I think that we all have, kind of a duty to take care of those people who come after us, to, you know, there's the phrase of like, science isn't done until it's communicated. That I think that that's true of the experiences we have in academia as well, where it's like, well, how useful is it for everyone to relearn the same lessons? We should be able to share them and also learn from them and say, this is not okay. You know, the system as it is not okay. And we can't expect somebody else to fix it for us.
Absolutely. You know, when I look at the listenership demographics of my show, and there's probably some real sampling bias because these are based on, you know, I don't just have access to that information. I have to do a survey. So you can click mm-hmm. through on any episode of my show if you're pulling it directly from my website and mm-hmm. And take a listenership survey, and it helps me for advertising. So, you know, this show is supported by selling ads and by Patreon, and advertisers want to know, like, who's listening to the show? Like, is, you know, is our product going to be right for them? So I look at these demographics and I see that probably the vast majority of the listeners of my show have high school diplomas, not all, but the vast majority. Also, a pretty big chunk have bachelor's degrees. And then I think compared to other shows, I probably have a larger percentage of masters and master's level and professional level, like, you know, JDs, MDs, PhDs, things like that. But of course, that's still a small percentage of my listenership. So I think a lot of the people that are tuned in right now may not even be aware of some of the real institutional failures and some of the real struggles and pressures that many of us experience navigating higher education. So I wanted to point out, I retweeted a tweet yesterday from someone named Jacqueline Siegel, who's also a PhD candidate, but she's studying social psych. And she wrote, "Academia is hard for married women. Academia is hard for single women. Academia is hard for women with children. Academia is hard for women without children. Academia poses unique challenges for all women. It's almost like it was designed without women in mind." And then, of course, other people added to that, you know, people of color, hear, hear, older adults, hear, hear, you know, a lot of other people that don't fit that kind of, again, cis, hetero, white, male, and rich, that's another thing. Like, people in poverty, of course, academia was not designed for them. And it's interesting that, A, I've gotten all sorts of horrible responses from people. And, like, at a certain point, you just have to kind of mute it because you're like, I can't even deal with this. They just don't understand. And like, it's difficult for me when people, I guess, see something like that. And instead of understanding that that is a historical fact, try to argue as to why that's not our experience.
Oh my God. Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, we get this all the time, which, you know, it goes one of two ways. One is somebody says, well, I had a great time. I don't know what people are complaining about, you know, and it's not, I mean, generally it's from white cis men, at least in my feed. But, you know, it's from people of all colors and all genders saying, well, not me, so it's not real. And I'm like, you're doing a PhD in astrophysics. Don't tell me you don't know how statistics work. You know,
and also, like, just because it doesn't affect me, it's not real, is like the definition of privilege.
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely. You know, and you look around, and I love that tweet. I'm going to go have to find it and retweet it. But
oh yeah, it was so great. I mean, it resonated so much for me that I just had to retweet. And then, of course, one person specifically, because I think that he's doing a little bit of the sea lioning thing, because he's obviously intelligent and he's asking for evidence over and over, which is like, okay. But he said, you know, saying that it implies it was designed by someone. Saying that implies it was designed by someone, in this case, big bad men, but it's a system that evolved and will continue to do so. Accusations aren't the basis for positive change, which, of course, I can't help but respond to and say, like, please don't mansplain to me about, like, how we women should be affecting positive change against institutional disenfranchisement. Like, what are you even talking about? And he was saying, you know, basically, I think instead of labeling and attacking, your communication should be based on common ground and empathy, which is such an eye roll. I think my response was something along the lines of, like, if you don't think women have been using that tactic for centuries, you're mistaken. It hasn't gotten us nearly as far as we'd hoped. Positive change takes hard work and dedicated activism. And I think that's sort of the crux of this issue, is that, like, we have been quiet and subservient, and I think in many ways manage the egos of the people who hold all the power for a really long time. And it has helped, and it's gotten us somewhere, but we're still, it's 2020, and we're still not seeing equal opportunity, like, not to mention outcomes. So, like, at a certain point, is the rabble rousing and the being angry and the, like, saying what we feel, I mean, isn't that how progress happens? Is that there's people at the bleeding edge? Unfortunately, in this system, doing that and saying that can literally get you blacklisted.
Oh yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
I look at it. I don't know. It, I just imagine, can you imagine writing a grant to propose the academic system as it stands? You know, that everyone...
Yeah. Hey, NIH, you want to fund this? They're like, ooh, that looks bad.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we're going to put a bunch of people who have never had any management training in charge of all different sorts of people. However, the managers are going to be from a handful of backgrounds that were originally trained from like one background.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
They're now in charge of this entire generation of people who have no real understanding of what is required of them. Everything that they're judged by is subjective. The amount of money and resources they have are ostensibly based on their ability, but really just limited by what titles they're working under, whether it's the institution or the manager itself. And then, by the way, the next job you get, your entire future career is judged by that manager. If that person doesn't like you anymore, well, good luck with getting a job afterwards. There's not very many other people who are going to vouch for you. You can get totally blacklisted, and all of these decisions are made behind closed doors. And I can't imagine anyone trying to write a grant in good faith saying, this is the system I would propose, because it doesn't make any sense.
Oh, absolutely not. And as that Twitter person implied, which I fully agree with, it's a system that evolves, but it when something starts in a really entrenched way, even its evolution can be slow and can be tedious. And, you know, the people who ultimately have the power, I think, are going to do everything they can in their arsenal to hold on to it and to propagate it. And so, you know, that's where nepotism comes from. And that's where, squashed opportunities come from. And I think it's always amazing when you look at the historical data and you look at, you know, how the system is rigged now, and you start to talk about it, people go, oh, come on, there's not a room full of like angry men twirling their mustaches. And you're like, yeah, exactly. I know there's not. It's not a conspiracy in the traditional sense. It's institutional. Mm-hmm. That's like what systemic and institutional means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and also there are actual rooms of men making these decisions, right?
And just because they're not nefarious in their, you know, proposals doesn't mean that they maybe don't have massive blind spots.
Right, right. Well, and like that Twitter person brought up that, I wish this was based on common ground. Well, of course you do, because it's uncomfortable, right? These changes are uncomfortable, especially if you're already sitting at the top of the privilege pile. Like no one really wants to lose the advantage they have, especially in a system that is based on competition as it stands right now. And it's going to take people across the board saying this is not sustainable. And even if I'm successful, if the entire system is crashing and we're hurting people and I'm not able to do my job because my coworkers can't do their jobs and it's just not good for me, we need those people to let go of some of their just original ideas of academia. They need to look at social sciences, at clinical psychology, read a management book. You know, if I went to another microbiologist and said, hey, I have, people do it all the time. Hey, I have a machine that's going to do your core work three times as fast. That person is going to be on their computer immediately doing price comparisons and understanding, you know, how can I get this and can it really do that? And it's amazing to me that they don't take the time to read some basic management books to understand like what kind of pressures are happening and how can I help? Because we know that people who are struggling, we know that people who don't see their identities, who are dealing with mental illness, who are dealing with imposter syndrome, that they are not as productive. And so it's, you know, you look at these labs of incredibly smart researchers, just really great logisticians in so many ways, who just have this huge blind spot because, well, that's not how it was done when I was there.
Absolutely. And I think there's also kind of a fear or a discomfort in trying to get quote unquote too political or trying to like, yeah, to change things, to be too loud, to stick out too much. Because, you know, that's not my role. That's not my mm-hmm. role. But ultimately, one of the biggest negative consequences of all of this is exactly what you mentioned. It's the internalized struggle that many, many, many people in academia face when they're battling the demons of mental mm-hmm. illness. And so what we see across the board is, you know, really high rates of kind of quiet struggles. You know, some universities are better than others about offering mental health support. Oftentimes, you see this, I think, a little bit more widely accepted within the undergrad population than within the graduate or the faculty population. Mm-hmm. And of course, mental illness, as we all know, is something that is, it is agnostic about who it wants to affect. So mm-hmm. it doesn't matter what your privilege is. It doesn't matter what your background is. Anybody can struggle with these demons. And so that's something that you founded PhD Balance to kind of try and tackle. Let us know, what is PhD Balance and kind of what is your mission statement?
So PhD Balance right now mostly exists on the internet. And I think there's some really cool aspects about that actually. But right now it's an online collaborative community where we're really working to provide resources for students to build kind of their own professional resilience, but also their personal resilience. And a lot of this is through opening conversation about those difficult topics that you're not going to be taught in a lecture, but rather you're going to be taught by a student who's 2 years older than you, who says, I've been through this same thing, or, you know, I also had an advisor who treated me this way. This is how I got through. Or even just saying, like, you're not broken. It's not your fault, but let me help you. And this was, we originally actually called PH Depression. And the reason.
Oh, right, because PhD. I dig it.
Yeah, I know. I loved that name. I was probably the last person who signed off on that change. But So many people couldn't say it if you hadn't heard it before. And I was like, oh yeah, that's a problem. not the best branding. And then, you know, we had a lot of people too, who came and said, you know, I don't have depression. I'm dealing with anxiety, ADHD, bipolar, all of these different things. Or they'd say, I wouldn't call myself depressed. I'm just dealing with XYZ. And so we switched over to PhD Balance to really reflect what you were saying at the start of balancing your life, balancing who you are, finding those things that bring you joy, and seeing your PhD as a part of your life, as something you really care about. But it's not who you are. PhD Balance is definitely a passion project. And I think what's really nice for me is that I started it as PH Depression, as some random Instagram page that I tossed out there. A lot of this was founded on this paper that came out in Nature Biotechnology. It was just a small paper that showed about 40% of graduate students around the world were dealing with signs and symptoms of anxiety or depression. And this was a really big wake-up call for me and also the science community in general. You know, these statistics or similar ones have been found in humanities journals forever. And what was really interesting to me is that I saw this paper and I was like, oh my gosh, this is such new knowledge. I wish that I had known this a year ago, you know? And then I got really fucking mad that I didn't, because it turns out this information already existed, but for some reason we weren't told it. You know, that if 40% of all graduate students, or, you know, it's the lower end estimates it at 25%, if one in four graduate students was dealing with chronic asthma and no one, like, and only half of those people were getting treatment, I'm pretty sure that everyone would stop for a minute and say, what is happening? And at least say, how do we support this? How do we make sure that people have the health insurance to go and take care of themselves? And just learning that this knowledge was out there, that it wasn't being taken seriously, I wanted to do something. And so I just started an Instagram page where people would put up their picture, the same kind of picture you see on Instagram, the same kind of image you would see at a scientific conference, you know, happy, excited, whatever. And then the story that they really wouldn't share about dealing with mental illness, about dealing with struggles, and taking those statistics and turning them into humans and saying like, yeah, these numbers are scary, but who are the people behind them? These are successful PhD students. And of course they are, because if, you know, 20% of graduate students who graduate are dealing with something like this, they're everywhere. This is just who PhD students are.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that that's such an important thing, not just for like, you know, obviously establishing the community and being able to look from the outside to say like, look, this is the evidence. Like you see a statistic, but these are like it's sort of like the qualitative portion of the quantitative research. But obviously the true import is the individuals who are in the community, being able to learn from one another and share their stories, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. You know, there's something to be said of just knowing that some proportion of the people around you are dealing with depression or anxiety, but what does that mean? You know, there's still such a stigma around it, and I catch myself dealing with it as well, that these people are somehow less reliable, or that you're going to be able to spot them. And that was another piece that when that Nature Biotech article came out, there were a ton of op-eds about it in Science Magazine and Inside Higher Ed, Chronicles of Education, all of these really big publications that academics lean on to understand the status of the system. And what was just hilarious for me is that all of them were accompanied by these photos of like stock photos of women crying in a window, or, you know, a student just like sprawled out over their desk, just desolate. And that's the problem, right? Is that, yeah, sometimes depression looks like I am just slumped over in the lab, but more often than not, it's me getting through the day, keeping some sort of smile on my face, making jokes and just kind of holding my breath until I can get home and lay on the couch and stare at the ceiling for 4 hours.
Way more often than not, because mm-hmm. that's the only way people are going to stay in their programs, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So it started just as this Instagram page, and people ask like, oh, what did you expect that to happen? I was like, I don't know. I thought like a couple hundred people would get together. I could find a few friends. We would be honest about our struggles. And it just took off really organically. It turned out that this is a really big need, that people want to talk about it, that people want to read these stories, and that they really want to support each other. I think the coolest things that I've seen from this project are people just commenting on each other's stories saying, hey, yeah, I had almost exactly the same experience. That was really hard. Good for you. Or we've had people who have tagged us in photos where they have met up with somebody who also shared a story, and that they've connected through PhD Balance and have found a friend through that.
I love that. I think that's really cool. And it's just so important, you know, just to be able to kind of basically survive. And I think, honestly, hopefully these kinds of movements ultimately will, I mean, I know it's not the direct sort of agenda, but ultimately will make their way back into the system, and that the individuals, because it is changing, you know, slowly but surely it is changing. We're seeing more women, we're seeing more people of color, we're seeing more people of diverse backgrounds starting to secure positions in administrative areas or in like advanced faculty positions, where they can bring a little bit of that mentality and that understanding into the role. And so knowing that things like this exist, knowing that there are people in positions of power who potentially could read this kind of mm-hmm. stuff, who could become at least a little bit more aware. Mm-hmm. That's just so fundamentally important.
Yeah. I've gotten a couple opportunities to speak at universities. And one of the things that I've really started to appreciate is how many people in academia really, really, really want students to succeed. They're not necessarily the people in the labs. Because a lot of times the people in the lab, that's not their main job. But most universities have dean of students office, and they have, a lot of them have graduate students offices. And the people who work in there have chosen that career path because they care. They want to see changes happening in the system. And even the last couple of years where I've started to learn more about what's going on, there are so many mental health task forces coming up. There's so many just national initiatives to really sit down, take a look at what's going on, take stock, and start making these big changes. And one of the pushbacks that I hear from people who aren't in a PhD, right? Because a PhD, we're a fairly privileged population just as a whole.
Absolutely.
You know, and that anybody who's doing a PhD, one, has really worked for it. I don't think you fall into a PhD program, but has experiences that a lot of, like, the huge majority of the world are never going to get. They're highly educated. They have the ability to attend a, you know, 3 to 7 to 10 year program. And so a lot of people will say, well, why even care about PhD students? Or, you know, why not focus on all of academia? Why not just stick with college students? And the reason that I usually give is that taxpayer dollars are paying graduate students. We know that people who are dealing, we can use specifically depression, we know that people who are dealing with depression take significantly more sick days and are much less productive without treatment. And so for people who are like, well, why should we care about this population? Well, because you're paying us, man. Like, your money is what pays for me to go to grad school and to do the research that is going to inform agriculture. Other people are doing, you know, medicinal research, that are doing clinical research. And if this population isn't being taken care of, like, we're wasting your money. So I really think that everyone should care about this, whether it's because they are in it or they love someone who's in it, or they just don't really want to waste money on a system that's not efficient.
Yeah, and talk about inefficiency. I mean, it's one of these situations where, like, it's hard enough as it is. Why do we consistently find examples where PIs and other kind of people with institutional power, like, intentionally want to make it harder? Mm. Maybe intentionally is not the right word, because I don't think that's always the case. I do think, though, you hear that mentality from a lot of people of like, ooh, you know, I can't make this easy for you, or like, you got to work for it, because if you don't, then you're not really going to appreciate. And it's like, dude, I'm working. Mm-hmm. Like, you have no idea how hard, you know, the people in your lab are working. So it's just such a funny thing to almost like invent or create obstacles to efficiency. There's the passive stuff, but there's also like literally active obstacles that are being creative. That's such a strange situation. I feel like I'm in a very privileged position. I'm in a very lucky position in that I'm working on a PhD in clinical psychology, which means that the vast majority of my professors are shrinks and they themselves are like so empathic, right? Because that's like foundational to being a good therapist, is that empathy is important to you, unconditional positive regard, you know, this like authenticity. I feel like I can talk to them if something is happening in my life that is preventing my academic success. I feel like I often do have a really understanding ear. But at the same time, when I see massive institutional failures, it's that much more of a slap in the face because it's like, oh, you should know better. You're a psychologist. But yeah, I compare that to my experience in the biology department when I was doing my master's in neuroscience, and it's night and day. And that's biology, where there are still more women and people of color. Then look at things like physics, computer science, mathematics, and it's like, oof. It gets rough out there.
Oh, yeah. Well, and so I kind of, I split between two just really big fields. One is microbiology, and, you know, that's kind of my home base. That's my one true love.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to, has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Love. But also plant biology. And it's really fascinating how the older the field is, the more entrenched in this kind of I don't know if machismo is the right word for it, but it's definitely this very big validation of the biggest, loudest man in the room is right. And
yeah, it's patriarchal in a deep way.
Yeah, exactly. And I look at, I get to go to these meetings and the American Society for Microbiology meeting where I did that TWIM podcast, was really cool because of all of the different initiatives that were around there to make sure that international people were there, that women were represented, that people of color were represented, that there were discussions about being LGBTQ, all of these amazing things. And then to go to some other conferences in different fields and see the huge differences in perspectives from scientists of the same ages. But that, I don't know, it's, you know, these people are working in the same buildings together. But yeah, I cannot imagine working in like computer science. Oh no.
It would be rough, you know? And I think that there's also a deep parallel between the lack of maybe awareness of inclusivity and the lack of prioritization of inclusivity and understanding and empathy. I see a direct link to that between that and the institutional failures of suppression of science communication. Mm-hmm. Because I've been to SciComm conferences where older, more entrenched, more established individuals would say things like, I don't agree with the term citizen science because I think that minimizes the work that real scientists do. Mm. Or would say, you know, just like bizarre things like, SciComm is great and it's important, I'll give you that. But like, you should never be, taking up your lab time doing these silly things. And you're just like, how even is this person so out of touch mm-hmm. with the needs and the requirements of like modern funding and mm-hmm. of, you know, mm-hmm. it's bizarre to me, but I see a link, right? Mm-hmm. Because if a system is designed to keep keep different perspectives out mm-hmm. and a system is designed to maintain the status quo, mm-hmm. then change is going to be really slow. Mm-hmm. And it's so bananas to me because we think of higher education as being fundamentally progressive and liberal, right? Like that's sort of the stereotype within American society is that like universities are liberal institutions, yet you see such conservative views. And when I say conservative, I don't mean politically. I mean, in terms of they do not want to change. Mm-hmm. They want to keep doing what they've always been doing. It's kind of the definition of conservatism. Mm-hmm. And that's so fundamental to the systems that are in place.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I sometimes get the question of, do you get pushback for running this community? You get pushback for talking so openly about your mental mm-hmm. illness. And I don't get pushback to my face because you can't say that. I'm very lucky that one, I have been so open about this that it's sort of intrinsic to who I am right now. And it's part of my identity. And that it's not something that's very in vogue for people to, I don't know, just to shit all over. It's not, that doesn't make you look good. But I have had a few chances to kind of peek behind the veil. And one of the most fueling experiences that I've had was about a year after founding PhD Balance. I was asked to write up an article or a set of articles for a societal journal. And just a kind of an op-ed situation. And they were very excited. The one of the editors was very excited, said, we'd love to have a series of this. We'd love to talk about graduate student mental health. It's something that's very important to us. And I said, okay, they said five. I was like, let's start with three. And I sent them over this pitch and he said, okay, I'll get it to the other editors. Got to the editors, sent me back his response saying, you know, we think maybe just one is good. You know, kind of the general stuff of what's going on, what are some ways to help, which would have been really boring had he not attached all the responses from these extremely high level professors. You know, this is, Whoa. Yeah, I recognized almost all of the names, not because I knew them as editors, but rather that like their papers are constantly discussed and they're the ones that you have to cite. And in general, it was sort of like, you know, this kind of played out right now. A lot of people are talking about it, but let's do something. Yeah. Which I was like,
so
okay,
played
I mean,
out,
oh,
you know.
Oh gosh. Yeah. I'm like, oh, we're bored. But
yeah. Oh God. All this like preventing suicide. It's so played out.
Like, yeah, what? Exactly. Like,
jeez.
It's overblown. But the one that like really fueled my fire to write a very different article is that somebody said, well, if we're going to publish an article about somebody who's dealing with mental health issues with depression in graduate school, we should really have in that same edition, we should really have an article from somebody who's still really excited about science.
What? As if you're not? And as if like, wait, oh my God, there's so many horrible things about that statement.
Oh, everything. So the article.
That's so stigmatizing.
Oh, it was awful. Oh, I was furious. So, but it was one of the more fun articles to write because instead I wrote an article that, that basically addressed every issue that they brought up of like, basically like why PI should give a shit and why this isn't just played out and why it does affect you directly, even if your student, you know, even if you don't have someone in your lab committing suicide, which is very common compared to the rest of the population. But even if it's just you're mentoring people who are really struggling, the worst thing you can do is say like, ugh, I just wish you were excited about science. That's really the
problem. Yeah, if you were just more excited, you probably wouldn't be depressed. So just let's work on that excitement.
Yeah.
It's also, yeah, it's so insulting. And it also, I think, having those responses really boosted the argument because it's, you know, some people, I think, look at these conversations, they say, oh, that's a straw man. Nobody's actually saying that you, you know, shouldn't work on your mental illness, or nobody's actually saying that there's not a place for you here or whatever. But it's like, nope, that's exactly what they're saying.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's lip service the same way that there's lip service for any underserved or any representative population where it's, well, of course we want diversity. Diversity is great. We really strive for diversity. And you're like, how? And they're like, well, we have we do a yearly symposium. We have a day where we talk about it and we put it in an email one time and you're like, wow, that's worse than nothing, actually. That is,
yeah, exactly.
You know, and I love too what you said about like mental illness does not discriminate, like it's gonna hit everybody. And then on top of that though is like mental illness doesn't discriminate, but wow, people do. And the kind of stigmas that these intersecting populations face is just incredible, where white people are more likely to get treatment. It's a less stigmatized topic in our society. People who are already undergoing just all of these other pressures that I will never face, I will never understand, don't necessarily have the support at home. They're already fighting to prove that they're good enough. They're already fighting to prove that they belong to be here. You know, it's not necessarily imposter syndrome. There might be a lot of people out there who are questioning that. And they are, you know, not treated at high enough rates. They aren't able to talk about it. And we know that being able to find an identity in your social circle that you can talk to, you can say, hey, you've dealt with this. Can I have this discussion? Is so important. And, you know, like you're saying with the demographics in especially different fields, you might have a situation where somebody is the only person of color in their department, right? You might have somebody who can never be honest about being LGBTQ because of the state that they're living in, because of the specific town that they're living in, because of their lab manager. And that's really where I think the benefit of an online you know, semi-anonymous community lies where people can find those identities and can learn from those stories, can find support, and can just realize a little bit more of like, no, this is okay. This is, you know, it's okay to need help. It's okay to not be healthy and have to accept that and say, you know, I am strong enough to go to therapy. I am strong enough to try these really scary things, to accept in myself that something might not be right right now. And just to hopefully get the support that they really deserve. You know, you're giving so much of your life, of your energy, of your passion to academia. I think academia owes its people so much more.
Absolutely. And, you know, in a lot of places, they aren't even, like, my school doesn't even offer health insurance. And so, you know, there's an expectation that you receive therapy if you yourself are training to be a therapist. Mm-hmm. It's not mandated, but it's expected. And I think it's a very good idea. I think that all therapists should have therapy on their, you know, on their own as well. And so there is that cultural shift where it's like, oh, we encourage this and we encourage the support and the help like you just described. Yet you got to figure out how to pay for it yourself, which is really hard for a lot of graduate students who are barely getting by, you know, on their, and like being in a professional degree, it's a completely different paradigm. It's the same for lawyers. It's the same for doctors. We pay for our schooling. Mm-hmm. We're not on, you know, if we're lucky, we can get scholarships, but usually we're not on fellowship. We're not receiving institutional support for the research that we're doing. We're actually paying to do that work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And most universities, people have this idea that it's mostly funded by undergrads, but if they were only undergrads, most universities would be functioning at a loss. That in a lot of these R01 or just research containing universities, they are primarily funded by research grants, which are primarily worked on by graduate students. There's a lot of, well, if you need help, go get help. And I just, my favorite question to ask of, you know, well, where should this person get help? If they're at university near you, or what kind of resources do you know? And very quickly, there's just not an answer. And academics, our main skill is thinking, right? Like I could be able to, one of the PIs I work under actually is very physically disabled due to a congenital disease or genetic disease. I'm using my words wrong, but you know, he's very physically disabled based on this genetic disease. And he is one of the most brilliant scientists in the field, able to do these just fantastic things, very well respected. Because his brain is amazing. His memory is amazing. His creative problem solving is amazing. And all of those things, memory, problem solving, creativity, are really hurt by mental illness. They're really not functional. And I just don't understand why, you know, our main value is our ability to think and to think creatively. I get so frustrated. We have 15-year protective services on a piece of machinery in the lab that is used four times a year. But why the hell aren't you giving health care to your students who are working, I don't want to know how many days a year, and they're literally breaking down.
Yeah, you're breaking down, exactly. Yeah, that's a good image, but it's true. It's absolutely true. There's obviously so much here to think about. I think for some people, this may be the first time that they're hearing about these kinds of issues in higher ed. Hopefully, even if you listen to the show and you yourself aren't personally involved in graduate level education, this has kind of opened up your perspective to some of those issues, because of course they do affect all of us downstream at some point. Susanna, I was hoping that before we go, I would have the honor of your answers to the final two questions that I ask all of my guests. And given kind of the the focus of the conversation today. I'm definitely interested in your perspective. So big picture questions, here they are. When you think about the future in whatever context is relevant to you, I want to know, number one, what is the thing that most keeps you up at night that you're most concerned about? And on the flip side of that, what are you kind of genuinely excited and optimistic for?
These were coming and I still wasn't prepared. I think the thing that keeps me up at night is this fear that even with all the knowledge we have, that people are just going to get worn out by the system, that people are somehow, you know, going to keep rising up through the ranks like it's always been. And by the time they get to a position of real power, that they won't follow through with all this amazing work that they're doing as grad students, as postdocs, to try to make these spaces more inclusive. I think that that's really what keeps me up at night is seeing all of these people struggle, getting all of these really horror stories from people, and just wondering, you know, are we going to see these same stories 10 years from now, 20 years from now? And, you know, does it really matter enough to people that they will make that change? But what's really exciting to me is to see that the conversation at least is opening, that there are initiatives that are starting, that people are talking about it. And compared to 10, 20 years ago, this is fairly brand new, especially in somewhere like academia, where people just didn't talk about work-life balance or mental health. And so I think that that in itself is a really tangible thing. People, I have idols even on Twitter, like Jen Heemstra is just such a rock star. She talks about mental health, about work-life balance as a faculty member, and seeing new young faculty members come out and start to talk about these same things. That's what's really exciting is just seeing these people being really brave, being really honest, and just going that extra mile to try to make things that much better for the people that come after them.
I love that. Well, gosh, Susanna, thank you so, so much for joining me today. Can you let everybody know, you know, where they can go if they want to be involved in PhD Balance and also where they can follow your science communication work?
Sure. So if you want to check out PhD Balance, the easiest place to go is just our website. It's www.phdbalance.com. That's a place where you can read people's stories. You can get resources. A lot of our stuff is originally shared on Instagram or Twitter. You can follow us along there at PhD_balance. We're always looking for more stories. We're always looking for resources. Basically, if you have something that you're like, oh, I wish I had this 2 years ago as a grad student or 10 years ago as a grad student, like just make it up because somebody else really wants it. And then for myself, if you want to follow along with the science communication, I talk ad nauseum about mental health and mental illness, and just kind of just generally talk too much. But it's you can find me also on Instagram and on Twitter at Susanna L. Harris. That's S-U-S-A-N-N-A, the letter L, Harris. And you can also find me that same exact name, SusannaLHarris.com.
Very cool. Well, Susanna, thank you so much for joining me. It was a really, really important chat that we had today, and I'm glad we were able to do it.
Well, thank you again so much. It's been an absolute pleasure, and shout out to Anna, because this is just super cool. So thanks.
Yes. Thank you, Anna, and thank you to everybody else who keeps coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.